Louis, today I'd like to talk to you and ask you a few questions about truth and reconciliation. I know that that's a pretty broad topic, but I have a few questions for you. You ready to talk about reconciliation?
Bring it on.
So for any listener out there who doesn't know about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, I'll give you a quick overview. In 2015, Senator Murray Sinclair delivered the final report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was a 10-year process that documented thousands of residential school survivor stories. This disgraceful part of Canadian history that spanned 160 years is just now being recognized as the genocide that it was. Malnutrition, disease, and physical and sexual abuse were common to all 139 of the residential schools in Canada. In addition to the thousands of children who died at these institutions, there was generational harm done to the family structure, the ability to love, trust, and learn as a human being. And the systemic racism that persists today has prevented Indigenous people from accessing services in health, justice, education, and their own cultural knowledge. In order to begin the healing of this long-lasting trauma, 94 calls to action were made part of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's report. These actions are meant to guide individuals, businesses, and institutions in learning the truth and begin dismantling colonial structures so that Indigenous people can begin to heal. They need to be able to relearn their cultural ways and to rebuild their communities. And when we say reconciliation, what we really mean is conciliation, because we never really had a respectful relationship to repair, so we need to start from the beginning. And the first step is to learn the truth. That's what we're here for, Louis and I, is to discover the truth, especially about Tsleil-Waututh culture and things that happened here on this land. So let's not allow the TRC report to be a binder on the shelf. Let's put it into action. Louis, I'm so grateful that we can have this conversation today, and I know that there's a lot of things that you want to share about reconciliation, but let's go back to the beginning. I want you to talk about things that you've told me before about being the first people. What is it? What does it mean to be the first people?
What I said was, our people walked this land for a long time. What I said was, things were different a long time ago. I think we were happy people. We had our own governance, we had our own health system, we had our own laws. Because I keep reminding people, when I first went up for my traditional sweats, I could hear the sounds of laughter of the old people up and down this valley. And I keep thinking about the time when they must have been happy people. Now when I go up, I tell people now I hear different voices, all in many different languages. And they're all words of anger. Because, when you think about it, our communication is so rapid now. We know what's going on the other side of the world. And they don't seem to advertise any happy stories. It's all about anger and wars and fighting, I said that anger is probably rubbing off on the people. And you've got angry people all the time, they're rubbing off on them. So where is our culture? Where's our ways? When they talk about truth and reconciliation, we got a long ways to go, I feel, because all our ways were gone. Most of our culture is gone, because when I try to really think about our culture, there's so many gaps in it. And it's hard to say, what is our real culture anymore? And I think this is what's confusing our people because of what happened at residential school or what the government did to us. And I think we somehow, we shouldn't have really let them, but it is what it is. But to rebuild our culture, I think it's going to be take an awful lot of work, and it's going to take a lot of talking to understand, even with my 50 years of knowledge on our culture, I still don't know the whole true story of our people. And our language is called Slakaya, the telling of the true story. And this is what needs to be done. A lot of research, a lot of archaeological work to start rebuilding that, a little bit of our culture back. I said, people are getting lost right now. You know, we don't really have an identity, a true identity, you know, a real Suwapmuk identity is what I'm talking about. And I think this is something that has to be strongly looked at.
That's the core of reconciliation, right, is understanding what was lost, that there's so many gaps in the cultural knowledge because of what was taken. And the break in the, because I didn't realize until I was, you know, reading especially Bob Joseph books, and that it was 160 years of residential school. Like, that is a lot of generations where the oral history and the stories and the knowledge, the plant knowledge, the, you know, everything knowledge was not passed on. I don't even know how that can be reclaimed or relearned. Is it even possible?
That's a good question. And my hope is that the younger people will step up now, you know, with the education level now and the technology that's there now. I'm kind of hoping that they will be part of the answer to the, or a solution to the problem. I just wish they would understand who they are and where they came from. And I think that's an important part of it, because we don't know where we're going unless we know where we came from. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's one of the key questions and one of the answers I think that should have been talked about.
So I think that there's a huge fortune and generosity in you that you remember a lot of your grandmother's teachings. So between you and your grandmother, we were able to go back three generations, four generations with knowledge. But that kind of relationship and that kind of knowledge is also disappearing very quickly because elders are leaving us.
Yeah, well, my grandmother's generation, I think it only went back to two generations, really. Because a lot of it wasn't really practiced when she was growing up, you know. She was just a baby. She remembers living in a pit house. And that was the most recollection she has on her culture. Mm. And most of the other stories that were told, it was the Slakaya that was taught to her, because her ways were already gone, or Suwapmuk ways were already gone by then. Because things have changed in her generation too.
Yeah.
And I don't think she ever went to residential school. Because there's some things they never talked about. Maybe it's the trauma or what, because a lot of things that, the bad things, they never really talked about it. And even the people who passed away, they never talked about them. There's gaps in our culture that I never fully understood. So it makes it difficult to understand who we are, the bits and pieces, and because I've been going through tapes and trying to understand more about it, and but like I said, there's a lot of gaps, and a lot of the, what really irks me now is that all the interviews were all done in English. Mm. See, that part of our culture that's disappearing is the language. Nobody bothered when they interviewed lot of our elders, all in English. Just think of the vocabulary that could have came out from that, just that interview, you know. So I only got a few tapes of my mother and my grandmother speaking Sawakmuk. I think listening to those brought it back, because I'd never spoke the language until 10, 15 years ago. And I could understand when people are talking in Sawakmuk, but now I'm putting fewer, more and more words together, you know. It's La Eskaluto Apiin, Sawakmuk. So, you know, it makes me kind of feel good to speak the language again, because it's kind of understanding who I am. You know, it's bug Phil about that, talking about Kultastut. Yeah, everybody figures I Kultastut. You know, I tell lies when I'm talking, because nobody can understand me. Because I did that once with the Minister of Agriculture. I got up, they asked me to do a welcome, and so I spoke in Sawakmuk. Minister of Agriculture kept coming up and asked me, what did you really say, Louis? And I said, I just translated what I said. And she came up to me 2, 3, 4 times, kept asking me that. After they left, a week later, her secretary phoned me just to follow up. And when I finished talking to her, I asked, oh, tell your boss, I want to know, find out what she really said. Throwing it back at her. Because, you know, government has a way of talking, you know. Maybe we'll help you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So they got a language of their own.
Yep.
So I threw it back at her.
So what does it mean to you when people ask you to do land acknowledgements? Or when people do their own land acknowledgements? Like, what is that actually, what does that mean? Is it actually a step?
I think it's a beginning steps of, I think a lot of people forget that we were the first people here. You know, they never really think about it, you know, because they're here now, they figured they were the first ones here, I think, sometimes. Well, I've had a farmer one time, we were doing the round table, Salmon River round table, and there was a farmer up the valley complaining about losing his land to the river eroding. Kept going in the river there, and I told him, yeah, I told him, we got that down the delta now, and you're not getting it back. Just a little reminder, you know, a subtle reminder about our title and rights.
Yeah.
But but everybody got it, you know. It brought a good laugh, you know. But, you know, that's why I say people don't realize, you know, we were the first caretakers here. And nobody really thinks about it, you know, because they figured they've been here for thousands and thousands of years, too. And I think it's a misconception that we don't really think about.
So what do you want to hear in a land acknowledgement?
I never really think about it. You know, sure, we're the first people here. But, you know, I think it's... I always remind people too, you know what, you know, like when they're talking about invasive species. And I told them, well, in 1492, the first invasive species came here. Took a little while for people to figure that one out, you know. And because everything is here for a reason. You know, invasive species are different species. They're here for a reason. And we don't really think about it. You know, I talk kind of hinting at people, but I'm talking about plants too. You know, we never really look at what they're good for. And we don't realize maybe they're important to the environment. Maybe they're here for a reason. Like I said, the first invasive species came in 1492. They're here for a reason, here to populate the land. And same with the plants now. They're here for a different reason, because we're changing the whole environment. They must be here for some reason, but we never really look at it. We just want to either pull it out or get rid of it. It's like any other invasive species, but we don't look to why they're here. Mm-hmm. Maybe health-wise, it might be beneficial to the environment or to our bodies. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Nobody really looks at it. And I think that, to me, that's what the land is all about, you know, is taking care of it.
Mm-hmm. So in the 94 calls to action, one of the sections that is being dealt with is poverty and housing. And I know that there's a lot of systemic colonial policies that exist in the economy, in the government structure, in the business structure, institutions that have had an impact here in Salmon Arm and on the Sahuatmic people. Some of the calls to action are about reducing barriers and including Indigenous people in, you know, things like job projects and things like that. Is that actually having an effect here?
That's a question, you know, that I always wondered about. Like poverty, most of the population think that, you know, the government gives us thousands and thousands of dollars. That's not the case. Yeah, maybe they should come and live on the reserve for a while and find out what it's like.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of misconceptions about special services that Indigenous people get.
Yeah.
There's a book out called 9 Myths That People Believe About Indigenous People, and mm-hmm. that's one of them, that there's, yeah. that, you know, that they get free this and free that and tax exempt and all that stuff. Oh my gosh, yeah. There's so much misinformation about that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, our housing is really bad. You know, I don't think we've had a new house now for about 40 years now. A lot of that was built for failure. Because under CMHC, people get a new house, but they forget about we have to pay that money back.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of our people were never working. They couldn't get jobs really outside the work, sort of. A little bit of farm work, or because our education level was so low, we didn't have jobs that would pay enough money to pay off our arrears on our housing. Because now, when people move into the city under the social assistance program, the government caps it up, so they get the people in town get their full payment for their rooms, whereas on a reserve, if there's not enough revenue, the band has to eat that revenue and contribute that towards the housing. So basically, it's not really a free house, so the band has to cover the amount owing on each one of the people aren't working, so
right.
It's not a free house.
Yeah, no. And so, also, you're not allowed to own the land that the house is on.
Technically we do, but we're still under the Indian Act, so it really belongs to the government yet.
Right, and it's also, you can't sell it. If you don't own the land that it's on, you're not able to sell the house.
We could sell it to other band members, but if you're from another band or not belonging to the band, you aren't allowed to own any property on our reserve.
Yeah.
It's
complicated, right?
I know.
And the thing that I learned too is that, yeah, CMHC will provide mortgages, and this is a program that they run for all kinds of, like, it's not just Indigenous people, it's for all, you know, everybody to underwrite mortgages for bands and community groups and stuff so that they can build low-cost housing and then rent that out to people. Mm-hmm. So that's a thing, but that's available to everybody. So that's not necessarily a special, you know, a special deal for reserves or anything.
No, the banks are getting into it now. Mm-hmm. And they're offering mortgage. But you have to really specify that you're actually working, can afford to make payments. So mm-hmm.
Yeah, you have to qualify just like
Like anybody else.
Yeah.
And I think our people are slowly getting up there, because look how long it took them to be able to get education enough to get higher paying jobs now.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that
Well, what about some of those jobs, though, that get promised during big projects? They. You've seen a lot of those come and go, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. I've seen the pipeline, the mica dams or the dams and hydro. They all promised big money and employment for our people. Once the projects are gone, so are the jobs, because I don't see any of our people working there anymore. And so that's just another way of getting their way. And I talked about revenue sharing, you know, because, you know, on Truth and Reconciliation, I believe that, you know, how do we give back to the people, the first people? Maybe revenue sharing should be more of it.
Instead of the temporary jobs, like for a year or 2 years.
Yeah.
Instead of that, or in addition to that, revenue sharing on the resources, which was supposed to be the original deal with all Indigenous people. And that's what the National Trust was for, right? Because the government said, oh, we're going to come in. We're going to come in and take all your resources, but we'll put a little bit of money aside in the National Trust so that we can support band activities in your communities. But it's such a puny amount that to get resource sharing agreements now with these big corporations that are pulling billions out of the country.
I didn't even know about that, so I guess that's all well thought of by the government, typical government, you know, they promise one thing, and because that's the way I look at this this Truth and Reconciliation in 94 Steps. Is it going to sit on the shelf again like any other deal they've done in the past? Mm-hmm. They've done so many studies and it all sitting on the shelf in Ottawa or somewhere and nothing really coming of it. They, oh, we done our due diligence, so let's get on with our lives again.
Yeah. But I do think that Senator Murray Sinclair, that was his goal in this whole report, is to and doing the 94 calls to action so that it didn't sit on a shelf, so that people could constantly refer back to the calls and see what it is that they are contributing to reconciliation. Yeah. And that's what today's show is about too, right? Like understanding what it means to us here in the Shuswap area, in the Sahuapmek territory, and what we can actually do that are actions so we keep moving forward.
Who actually read it?
Have you not read it, Louis?
No. I've seen it on at one of the ministries, a little pamphlet there, and I asked the worker, did you guys read this? I started reading a little bit of it. Did you guys read it? Oh, no, we're going to get down to it, but did they actually read it?
Yeah.
Were they mandated to read it or not? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Because well, I think it's typical, you know, we'll get to it later.
Yeah, yeah. When it first came out, we had a circle at the gallery that we had the binder, we printed out all 94 calls, and we had a big circle, and we passed that binder around, and every person read one of the calls to action out loud. And so we were able to talk, like we talked in between some of those two. It was a 3-hour process because there was a lot of sharing and a lot of discomfort. And, you know, it's horrible to ask people to relive trauma, but there was a lot of trauma in the room. And reading some of these calls to action brought some of that stuff to the surface. And that was really tough for a lot of people. But but it was a really important step in us understanding what this document is supposed to do.
Yeah. Didn't Jack Nicholas say it really good in The Shining? The truth, you can't handle the truth.
It's not The Shining.
Because, you know, the truth is really hard to accept.
The truth is really tough. Like, people don't want to, it's uncomfortable. Yeah. And I think that's what one of the problems with, you know, that people can't move forward with reconciliation because truth comes first and they're so not comfortable learning the truth. They're convinced that, well, that wasn't me. I didn't do that. You know, they just want it to go away and they say, let's just look to the future. Let's just focus on the now.
Yeah.
And oh my gosh, if we don't understand our own history and learn the true history of this country, then we can never move past what has happened and be able to heal and do better. So yeah, I'm pretty passionate about that. Learning the truth. And there's easy ways to learn the truth. It's called books. You can read books. And there's a lot of resources out there that are not long, complicated, like, you know, textbook sort of stuff. You can read lots of people's sharings and stories to help you learn that real truth and then move from there.
I remember I brought it up at one of our Truth and Reconciliation at the Art Gallery. Mm-hmm. Remember, I said, the only way you could have truth and reconciliation is getting to know one another first. That's the first step in truth and reconciliation.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it's not possible. Because how many people do you know? If you look at somebody, you know, what do you know about them? So how could you learn the truth if you don't talk to them?
Yeah.
You know, as simple as that.
Yeah.
It's something you might be reading in a book, but to know each individual personally, I think, is even better than reading from a book. Hmm. Personal experience, I think, is one of the biggest things that you can really learn.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go on to another question that the 94 Calls to Action address, and that is the justice system and the prison system. And that's something we know is a large factor, statistically speaking. There's the population of Canada, there are 5% Indigenous people, but in the prison system, it's about 50% Indigenous people. And it was worse in the past. It was, I think you said it was like 80%.
Yeah, it was probably around there at one time.
Yeah.
Because I think out of sight, out of mind mentality by the court system. They didn't know what to do with us. So the Indian problem, they always call it. So out of sight, out of mind. So,
do you see any of that changing?
I think it is. I think it was alcoholism that made our people always in trouble. And alcohol was never part of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
I think we talked about this a long time ago. And, you know, our people are so reliant on their natural sugars. And as soon as they introduced the refined sugar to our people, they found that they were readily addicted to it. And that's why, what is alcohol made from? You know, chocolates, pop, candy. You find the majority of our people are addicted to it. So naturally, when they introduced alcohol, I think our people readily became addicted to it. So things were different. I think it was back in the 50s. I remember our first youth getting drunk. She called wine colored water. And she says, you guys got to try some of this colored water. It's good. Here we're packing her back on one of those little red wagons and to bring her home. But you know, that was the beginning of the alcohol problem on our reserve. You know, about 99% of our, 100% of our people drank back then. And I think in the 60s, the younger people started more and more alcoholism. And that's when our jail started getting full.
Because
in the First World, that was after the Second World War, when our men were allowed to go out and drink, be men sitting in a bar, getting drunk and be a real man. Because I remember the days waiting outside the Montebello, waiting for my mom and dad to get out of the bar. Spent about 4 or 5 hours outside playing around, waiting for them.
Mm-hmm.
So things were way different. And I talked about that a little bit. And I don't know whether the residential school were lucky at that time because they were out of the way of their drunken parents. So
complex trauma.
Yeah,
neither option is good.
Yeah.
But so it just happened that with the breakdown of the family structure and the.
Yeah, well, that even helped the breakdown of the family structure too. Not only the residential school, but there's other contributing factors too.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's drugs, you know, that are playing a big part in it now.
Yeah.
I lost a daughter to it here a few months ago, and still has its effect on me, you know, and what can you do about it, you know? And I think our people are slowly getting their lives together now, I think a better understanding of what's causing it. I think healing is coming around. And there's some hope for us.
Yeah, well,
this is not Bob Hope anyway.
I think one of the things that people that don't understand trauma and don't learn about it is that there's never any one thing. It's not just one thing.
Yeah.
It's so complex and it's piled on top of each other. And so the pain of that, the constant and chronic pain of multiple traumas and generational trauma, makes it nearly impossible to dig yourself out from under.
Well, there's...
There's absolutely hope and there's tools and ways that people can do it. It's just that then they've got to have access to services. And that's part of what the 94 Calls to Action is trying to do, is say, well, we've created barriers to these services for Indigenous people. Now there has to be ways to open up, and not just open up, but to actually very specifically say to Indigenous people, okay, we have a service for you, and it's actually designed for your cultural ways rather than the colonial ways.
Yeah, but you got to remember, denial works both ways. We deny things, and the people on the other side, they deny that it actually ever happened. Look what happened when they first talked about residential school years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody denied it then. Well, it didn't really happen.
Yeah.
It took the finding of the bodies before people realized, you know, that there is something to it.
There is still denialism. There are still people that say, even after the bodies, that they're saying, no, that was just made up.
Yeah, yeah, but we're denying it too, as I think, because, you know, everything's still going nice, you know, but we don't realize some of the effects of what happened. We're still acting it out. You know, we're denying it too, I think, in a sense. Oh, I don't need help. I'm okay. So these are some things that we got to think about.
Yeah, that's human nature too, right?
Yeah.
We kind of like to pretend everything's okay.
Everything is fine.
Okay, so getting back to the reconciliation report and the 94 calls to action, there's quite a lot of it that is the responsibility of government. It's regulation, it's title and rights, it's health services, and ways that businesses can do things, right? Like there's lots of kind of regulations and policy work in there, but there's a lot of things that individuals can do. One of the things that people ask me about frequently is about cultural appropriation, what it means to appropriate cultural imagery, sacred objects, things like that, from Tsleil-Waututh people. And where is the line in terms of supporting Tsleil-Waututh makers, people who make jewelry, dream catchers, clothing, things like that? So I'd like to talk a little bit about that. Like, can you share with us some of the things that you want to see shared, that are important that people embrace, the art forms, the singing, the, you know, the practices, but, and then others that are not, others that are sacred, and it's just inappropriate for people to try to learn more and adopt those things.
Yeah. Well, personally, myself, I find I'm too liberal in my sharing.
Yes, you're very generous.
I never think about, you know, what is illegal in our sharing. I think the sharing is really about... sharing of our culture is really about, I think, better understanding who we are. I think that kind of works both ways. Because the more we get into our own culture, the more willingness to share of what it's all about. Because I remember the time when my mother used to go on powwows and sell our artifacts. We weren't selling artifacts. We were selling our culture, you know. What's a basket? What it was used for, you know, and how long did it take us to make it? Or even a buckskin glove or a buckskin jacket, anything. We talked about all that, So we weren't really selling an article. We were selling our culture. Mm-hmm. And people, a lot of people want it for next to nothing. They don't realize the amount of work that's put into a simple basket or something. Oh, yeah, you could. They're easy to make, but they don't realize how much work is involved in doing it, or tanning a hide, you know, or anything that's involved in our culture that has to be recreated. People never really look at the true value of what was done to it. You know, you got people selling their basket for $20, and here they put in about 30 hours of work on it sometimes, you know, just going out and gathering the material alone. Yeah, that takes time. Everybody figures, you know, it can only takes you an hour to make each basket, but they don't realize the work that puts into to get it done.
Yeah.
So value is something that nobody ever really thinks about, you know. So it's as taboo, there are some things that should be protected, you know, and like some of our history, you know. You know, the pictographs or old villages, you know, those have to be protected. Because people go up there and they literally trash some of the places, and they never think about the true value of the history that was, why it was there. So these are things that have to be strongly looked at, because I think it was just until recently they started trying to protect pictographs, and I don't know whether it's legislated now or not to find people if they're caught desecrating it. I mean, you know, if you go up to City Hall and you spray painted it,
yeah, you get in
put
trouble.
Your own pictographs on there. I don't think, you know, they won't allow that. Mm-hmm. They're not even allowing pictographs anywhere around town.
Yeah.
Unless they get an okay from City Hall first. Mm-hmm. So, but these are kind of things I think that nobody really looks at, you know, and I think it'll come down to it, you know, the more people, maybe this part of this is truth and reconciliation, maybe it's part of that passing laws that will protect our so-called history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, staying really local here in the Salmon Arm area on the Sohutmik territory, what are some things we can do right here that actually work towards reconciliation? Very specific to our land. Like, I think that's one of the things that almost everyone that lives in this area can agree on, is that we live in a very beautiful, pristine area. So here we are on ancestral territory that was lived on for at least 15,000 years before settlers got here. What can we do to work towards reconciliation?
I think admitting it is one of the first steps. But I always wondered about that, you know, because it's kind of like a personal question. Because it involves, you know, thinking of yourself and other people. So that question is really difficult to answer, and I struggle with that. How do you repair a wrong? It's like if you cut yourself, you put a Band-Aid on it and hope it'll heal. Because it'll always leave scars, no matter what. I always say, as OAM, Kweta Ziani Atamiha Akalmu. As you humanita yani atamiuch, sapatayam huwait as you humanita. I think we can really talk about truth and reconciliation is truth and reconciliation to the land too. To me, that's the most important thing, because Yamas Ayapas Yami Atamiuch. Walapas, yeah. The land is fighting back now with all the fires, the flooding, the hurricane, tornado, slide. because we're disrespecting it. You know, you look at it. Yam Kosaltan, Yam Kosaltan Uyas, Yami Tamil. Everything in this land is our relative. And we're supposed to look after our relatives, but we're not. Papas Yam White Stam. I said everything is disappearing. Because you look at all our trees are gone, all our fish are gone, all our deer are gone. All our plants are disappearing. And that's why I say maybe the land is getting mad, because they are our cousin, our relatives. And if things don't get any better, you know, maybe I don't want to be a doomsayer. You know, I'm just saying that, you know, how do we make reparation to the land? How do we give back what we've taken? Because all our Chiptekul, I say that, if you keep taking and taking things, you know what, somebody's got to pay. There's always famine to follow. So you really think about it. How do we give back to the land what we've taken?
Well, let's actually identify some things.
Well, I see over the news release that the government wants to plant 10 billion trees. But is that just money trees for the forestry?
Mm.
How about the other plants that are vital to the environment? You know, the deciduous trees.
Right.
All the plants and the animals are there for a reason. Where's the water? You know, how are we going to put the trees back in there if there's no water?
Mm-hmm.
All they'll do is end up burning up. So these are questions that even I can't answer, and I don't think anybody really thought about the answer to that question. How do we give back what we've taken?
Well, and how do we give back in a way that is sustainable long-term? Because you're right, there's monocultures being planted all over the place because those trees are designed to be product eventually, rather than repairing the forest, which would be a diversity of species. And like you said, like deciduous trees, because you told me about how those were natural fire breaks when deciduous trees were growing along stream banks and stuff.
Yeah.
That would slow down a wildfire.
Yeah, and maybe put it out. And eventually it'll put it out, but, you know, same with the water. As soon as the trees are gone, it seems like all our creeks dried up, you know, and disappeared. So where did they go? They don't leave the environment.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they moved somewhere else. Maybe they moved to China or all the other places that are getting the flooding now.
Yeah.
I've never heard of the water leaving the environment. So where does it go? And the ice, the glaciers up north, where are they going? Where's the water going? It's a question I think that I'd like to know the answer to that one too.
Yeah. And when we do have water, so we're in like such many, many years of drought. But when we do have rain, there's no way to hold it in the mountains because of so many trees being cut down and the monoculture forests that have been put there instead don't perform the same way.
Then when no trees there to hold the, to kind of cap it, the mountains, because when the snow falls, when you think about it, when the snow falls in the winter, it trickles into the aquifer. Then when now there's no trees to hold it back or anything, it doesn't trickle in there. And the sun hits it and it just whooshes right down into the rivers and the creeks.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not much water going into the aquifers.
Yeah.
So when you think about it, I mean, that's my theory and I'm sticking to it.
Well, cultural knowledge and science are the same, right? Like that's the thing about the history with the land is that you know things. The scientists are just now figuring out and saying, hey, there's this thing. And you're like, yeah, we knew that.
Well, sometimes I wonder about that because there's a lot of questions I have. You know what? A lot of things make sense. You know, when our people were out there harvesting, I think they were creating fire barriers too. Mm. You know, when they're tilling the soil, digging up their digging up their roots, traveling all over in the interior here, harvesting their stuff. You know, they were looking after the land. They relied on Mother Nature to help feed us. So we're out there tilling the soil too, looking after it, mm-hmm. in a sense. So, and keeping the fish population down a little bit and respecting it. With everything we do, we're supposed to offer a pairing of thank you to Mother Earth. I find I'm guilty of that a lot of times. I always forget about it because, see, it wasn't practiced in my time. Mm-hmm. To keep that up, every time you break a branch, you're supposed to make an offering or even give a thank you for helping. So there's a lot of things that, you know, in our culture that we're slowly forgetting. How do we take back what we've lost? Is my question.
Yeah. Well, and that's yeah, what's been lost, some of it is lost forever. You're having to remake your culture based on...
I think instinctively we know, our people know, you know, maybe one day we'll all wake up and smell the coffee and understand more. Because, you know, a lot of times I wondered about that, you know, because it's inherent in us, I think. Because when my grandmother and grandfather moved into a log building after they moved out of pit houses, and I never thought about it at the time, but every spring they built a summer cabin. And they went over there in the summer, they took all their caulking out of the log house and they let the log house air out. Just like in the old pit house, they took down the women's entrance and they let it air out. Mm. And I think that was so inherent, and they had to get out from the winter home and move into a summer home. So they moved into the summer home because it was their way of, they can't get back out in the land anymore because it was all taken up. And so this was their way of doing part of what they did for centuries because it was so inherent in them, they had to get out of their winter home. So, and I think to me, there's something back in the recesses of our mind that will understand, you know, what the true meaning is. And I think it'll come out, just like me with the language. I didn't know I could speak it until 10, 15 years ago. So that's my understanding. And like I said, that's my story and I'm sticking to it.
So keeping with the topic of reconciling with the land, but also addressing questions from random people. A lot of people do say, what can I do? What can I as an individual do to help reconcile with the land?
Good question. That's why I'm saying I don't have the answers, and it's going to be hard for anybody else to have the answer because our concept is not this. It's not looking after it. Our concept is taking. You know, we're never really in the process of giving back. You know, they planted a few trees. But the other trees and all the other parts of the environment are slowly disappearing. And how do we give that back? You know, this is a question I think for a lot of people to get together and talk about maybe. Because I don't have the answer. You know, how do we give back? We can bring back some of our traditional plant, our edibles. I always maintain that, you know, we got enough land to sustain all of Canada, right across the land of Canada. We got enough land there to sustain our own people, mm-hmm. our own Canadians. Because it sustained our people for thousands of years, so why can't it sustain our own people for thousands of years to come if we learn to look after it?
Mm-hmm. So that's a thing. People can learn how to create gardens and yards that are full of indigenous plants and attract pollinators, and they can grow their own food and food for animals, birds to eat, so that there's some balance, even in tiny little pockets in your yard, there can be some balance of yeah. giving back to the land. That's one thing people can do, is yeah. just focus on their own little...
Yeah, but you forget about the people that are in town. How are they going to feed themselves?
Yeah, it's, well...
That, you know, it's how do here. We... Because that's a big question, too, you know. That's why maybe there was a recession, you know, because back in the hungry 30s, they asked my grandmother, how did you guys survive the hungry 30s? She said, what's that? Because they still kind of lived the old way. You know, they smoked their own salmon, their deer, their meat. Preserved, they had little root cellars full of root crops, berries. Mm-hmm. So they didn't really suffer. What I understand was mostly the people living in town. They couldn't feed themselves.
Yeah.
So I think that the big question is, how do we support those people living in towns and start looking at different ways of looking after the land, like our people did for thousands of years? And, mm-hmm. and how do we look after the people in town? Because, they're our Kalmuk, you know.
Yeah.
Kalmukuluk, they call it, land of the people. So... in order to look after all the people, you know what, we got to learn how do we help them out when there's a crisis. Because in all our history, all our Chiptakwala, they always seem to talk about famine. There's a little bit of famine going on for thousands of years, and our people learned how to deal with it. So, and I think that we never think of it as nationally. If there's a famine, how do we deal with it? So these are questions I think that we have to put on thinking caps and think about that one.
Yeah, well, there's been a lot of discussion about how amazingly productive this area could be if we did focus on sustainable agriculture. But, you know... things happen, housing, industrial park, development, things like that, right? So, yeah, it's definitely something that agricultural societies, I know like John McLeod was a big advocate for talking about the agricultural potential here. We could feed our whole community in the Shuswap, no problem. So that's that's a thing that we can all work towards as individuals for sure.
Yeah, well, all our traditional plants are disappearing too. They get smaller, disappearing. Because I was mostly involved in our salmon, looking after our salmon, but they all pretty well gone now from our river. So, like my mother, I started looking at the plants, and it's like as if they told me, "We're going to leave you if you don't need us anymore." So I started really looking at our plants, and I was like to see our people getting back out in the land and start harvesting all the plants. Right now they like going out for huckleberries, Saskatoon, Supilali. But they don't look at our root crops, you know, and they followed it always up to Revelstoke. Revelstoke, I think, is usually the last stop when they go out hunting and gathering all summer long. Mm-hmm. And they went all the way up there because you could still see a lot of it up, especially up Mount Revelstoke at the park there. And that's what I told them, you know, we got to start, you know, they're so proud of their flowers, their beautiful flowers up there. And I reminded them, you know what, you got to be like our people, you got to learn to look after it. Like our people went there, they every summer they went up there and they harvested, they tilled the soil. Make sure to keep growing. Mm-hmm. And if you just leave it like they were doing, you know what, it's going to eventually disappear like everything else. So these are things that we don't think about.
Yeah.
You know, we like the beauty, but how long is it going to be there? Because beauty fades. I think a lot of people, especially us older people, we know that. Anyway, so... but, you know, there's a whole bunch of questions, you know, and I think that it's a matter of sitting down and getting to know one another. And I think, like I said, that's where truth and reconciliation comes, getting down, sitting down with each other. And
So that's your advice of the day. Sit down, talk to each other, talk to people with different backgrounds than you. Have coffee together at the A&W. And that's a step in reconciliation.
Yeah, I don't have any coffees I've had down in A&W.
Thank you, Louis. This has been even better than coffee at the A&W today. Thanks for talking about reconciliation with us. And I do recommend that everybody read the 94 Calls to Action. It's not a novel. It is a very manageable thing to read. And you really do get a sense of the things that we can do and to create pathways to healing.
Yeah. But even that looks like a novel to me. I hardly have been reading now in the last quite a few years. I'm always busy.
You are busy. You are always in demand.
It's always something coming up. And just like me and my mother, we'd start tanning a hide and we'd have to put it in the freezer and go off. And I think one hide, we might still have a hide in one of the deep freezers yet. I don't know. But, you know, it's always something coming up. And so...
It's okay. You don't have to read them. It's all the settlers that have to read them. So that's our job. That's our next job.
Well, I think it's our job, too, to know what they want of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, otherwise we'll never understand. They'd be coming talking to us about it, and what are you talking about? So I think it's a matter of everybody sitting down together and going over it and understanding what it's really all about. Mm-hmm. Is it just another government scam? Or
Well, and that's another thing that can happen on September 30th, on the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, is people can gather, have conversations, and talk about the 94 mm-hmm. Calls to Action. Mm-hmm. So there you go. So thank you, Louis. This has been a great day, and we'll talk to you next time on Slahaia.